Our last speaker this morning is Ellen Shader, my boss, and the director of River Restoration at American Rivers, who is going to discuss how to plan in advance to rebuild after disaster strikes.
Hi all. So, as we said, I'm Ellen Shader. I've been with American Rivers. Been with American Rivers for almost 9 years. Here in DC, where I've been working on sort of the federal side of advocating for policies to protect and restore rivers, and just relocated to Pennsylvania, so I'm really excited to start stepping back from that lobbying role and actually start working more on implementation of projects around the country and actually hopefully see some results on the ground down the road. So I wanted to sort of continue a little bit of our policy discussion on the federal floodplain and flood risk policies, but also start to bring it closer to the work on the ground and how we can actually try and improve the existing systems that we have. So, we all know this, we don't need to spend much time talking about the fact that climate change will bring more precipitation. We've seen dramatic increases in precipitation over the past century, and climate forecasters say that we will likely experience more frequent and extreme storms in the future. And more precipitation obviously means more floods. To me, more floods mean that there are going to be more opportunities for floodplain restoration and reconnection. The floodplains are really amazing places. They are pretty incredibly diverse and dynamic ecosystems. There are many species that have evolved to reproduce or spend part of their life stages on floodplains, so we all know they're incredibly important environmentally. And they provide many, many benefits to humans, from filtering pollutants out of water, trapping sediment, reducing flood damages, and provide a buffer that helps protect the built environment. However, our traditional means of managing floods have been with using concrete, so levees, dikes, dams, culverts, channels, all of the things that you all work on and fight against probably on a daily basis in your states and communities. And as we know, these all eliminate the connection between rivers and floodplains. They push water onto someone else, make it someone else's problem, which usually ends up with them wanting to build things with concrete, destroys ecosystems, and unfortunately can lull people into a false sense of security so that they build more in areas that are vulnerable. And concrete often feels very permanent. It's very difficult to try and change our existing infrastructure, but it fails. Often it's going to be catastrophic and extremely costly to rebuild. And there's a lot of pressure to rebuild quickly. However, if you prepare, do the work ahead of time, you can actually make some changes when it is time to rebuild. And you can use natural approaches, whether it's enlarging culverts and putting in much larger stream crossings to be able to handle floods after a road washes out. If it's taking out the hazardous dam that has failed or is threatening to fail during a flood. The photo in the center is in Massachusetts, near Taunton, Massachusetts. And I just love that picture of the elected officials, Senator Kerry and Kennedy, Governor Romney. They're not quite getting out on the dam as threatening to breach, but standing there getting their photo off in. Or levees can fail and often damage the infrastructure that's been built behind them. Sorry, lost my place there a little bit. There's a lot of different terminology that can be used about what those natural approaches can be, depending on which agency you're dealing with, or even which program within an agency. At the core, different approaches tend to be non-structural. Now we're seeing natural approaches and nature-based approaches, which is the more current terminology, as we saw with the flood risk management standard. But I sort of group many of them in the same category. And oftentimes they can be talking about the same sort of projects. And one of the types of projects I wanted to talk about today was adapting our levee systems. When a levee fails, and whether it's been breached, been overtopped, the Corps is frequently going to go in and repair that system. And there's a push to do it as quickly as possible. It's very, very rare that they actually make changes to the existing levee system. However, there are several examples in recent years where they have done that. And I just wanted to walk through a couple of them and sort of show some of the similarities, the work that was done ahead of time that allowed these to move forward. So the two examples I'm going to talk about, one is on the Missouri River in Iowa, the other is on the other side of Iowa on the Maquoketa River, which is a smaller river system. And both examples concern levees that were enrolled in what's called the PL 8499 program, which is a ridiculously wonky name for it, but essentially means that if a levee meets the Corps of Engineers standards and is enrolled in this program, then once it's damaged, it will be repaired either at full funding, 100% full federal funding, or 80%. So the local sponsors would only have to pay up to 20%, which is pretty small. So this first example on the Missouri River, this is following the 2011 flood. This is the L575 levee. It's a 46-mile earthen levee, protects mostly agricultural lands, was extensively damaged in 2011 in 21 locations. There were breaches in 3 locations, seepage, boils, erosion, scouring. It was basically in really bad shape. And one of the reasons for that, if you know your Missouri River history, you know that the Corps of Engineers has trained that river, put in all these river training structures to narrow the channel, make it deeper for navigation, and then basically created more land on the side, and then they built the levees on top of that. So it really constricts the channel. So there are many places where you do see repetitive losses over and over every time there's a major flood. In the area, they know where those locations are. They tend to be where the river is very constricted, no surprise. So in this map, the yellow line is the where the previous levee location was. The red are where they did levee setbacks after the 2011 flood. And these are just a couple of additional photos, two aerial photos of those sections that we're showing on the map, where you can see some of the different, this was sort of right after or during construction, so you can see the pits that would eventually become these wetland systems, and they're seeing significant waterfowl populations that are using these post-restoration, and the wetland vegetation is coming back. And so the project, these levee setbacks actually reconnected around 2,000 acres of floodplain land from this project. It was able to give the river more room to flood, which reduced flood stage by up to 2 feet really slowed the velocity, and there's some critical infrastructure in the area. There's a nuclear power plant, there's also a coal power plant, that this really helped reduce the risk of failure at those locations. So that's incredibly important for the communities that they're going to have their electricity. That always helps people recover faster after a flood when you don't lose those utilities. There's also obviously clear benefits to the environment to have access to that floodplain land. We are seeing the rebound in wetland plants and the waterfowl and other species that rely upon them. One of the reasons that this project, well, there are numerous reasons why this project was able to move forward. And I have to say, the Omaha District staff have done a fantastic job of looking for these opportunities. They really see the value in doing levee setbacks. And they, but they were originally planning to just rebuild the levee back to its original place after it had been damaged. I've heard from their staff that they held their public meeting, and there's an elderly farmer in the area who tearfully pled with them to please do something different. Don't rebuild in the same place. They've been doing that over and over again, and he just couldn't do it again. He wanted something different. He needed to make sure that his land was going to be safe down the road. So they went back to the drawing board, and they developed these setback project ideas. They wrote a conceptual paper to support them that was actually pretty progressive. And it pointed out many of the reasons that we would all argue why these are good projects. They looked at the long-term cost-benefit analysis of having to rebuild the same infrastructure over and over again. They incorporated potential ecosystem service values. They pointed out that these were repetitive damages and that it was going to improve safety for the overall system. So they went through all of these different factors that traditionally you don't tend to see, as it explained so bluntly in the Corps of Engineers reports. And it also helped that in this area there had been work done to acquire these wildlife management areas, partly for some of the ecosystem restoration that's going on in these areas. So they were sort of prime locations to do setbacks because a lot of the land was already protected. The second project I wanted to talk about, like I said, also a Corps of Engineers 8499 levee project, much smaller area. This is about 360 acres in Iowa, also agricultural land. And it's in 2010, the sand levee was breached in two places, which flooded the agricultural land behind it. Like the Missouri River example, a lot of the land had already been a target of conservation efforts. It was much of it was already enrolled in the NRCS conservation programs, and it's adjacent to another wildlife management area. So the staff there, the Iowa State staff, had their eye on this land. That if the opportunity arose, they really wanted to acquire it and add it to the wildlife management area. Also, like the Missouri River project site, these were repetitive loss projects. These levees had failed multiple times. So they basically knew they were going to fail again in the future. And the Corps of Engineers staff didn't do quite the same robust conceptual paper justifying their reports, but they did do their traditional benefit cost analysis that you have to do for a rebuilding project like this. And in this case, because it was all agricultural land behind, it's all cornfields, the benefit cost just did not support rebuilding again. wasn't worth it for them. So they proposed a non-structural alternative, which was to leave the levees breached like they were and transfer the land behind it to someone else. I think this is more of a passive restoration project where they just left the land to for the river to reclaim the land and basically see what happens. Whereas the Missouri River example was a much more active restoration project where they were physically moving dirt and building new levees. And then they sort of did some of the work. They built their borrow pits, basically. You know, when they dug holes where they took dirt and built the new levees, but they kind of just left it the way it was so that the natural seed bank would rejuvenate the wetlands area. But they didn't sort of plan it for the for the best environment for the environment, because that wasn't what the purpose of the project was. Whereas this one had, it was passive, but they also had a lot more natural resources staff involved from the state, and USGS has been very interested in it. So there's a lot of monitoring happening at this location that they're trying to see what the benefits are of this project. So, scrolling through here, but just a couple of other photos. This was one I took after the breaches, when the land was still had been farmed. As you can see, it's a little cornfield. This is the same field in 2014. So they're seeing regular floods several times a year where the water is actually accessing the floodplain. Bringing in or rejuvenating the natural beneficial functions of that floodplain area. And there's just another pretty photo of the area. So now, I'm sorry, I'm going on to a little policy and word slides, but I just want to talk a little bit about, I think, the benefits or the steps that folks can take on the ground to try and ensure that these non-structural or natural approach projects can that we can take to move these forward after a flood. And it can be really difficult to change levees, because there's going to be a local sponsor that has a pretty vested interest in keeping the levees exactly where they are. But if you build the case ahead of time, there's potential to make some changes. I think one of the first changes, or the one first thing you need to do, is know where your levees are and their history. The Corps of Engineers has been trying to map levees, but they really only have a decent grasp on where the federal levees are, the ones they have something to do with. There's a lot of much smaller agricultural levees and things like that that we just really don't know where they are. And there might be opportunities to work with them, but it totally varies by states, the information and the data they have on those. I think it's also important to know what the history of those levees are. Have they failed in the past? If they have failed in the past, there's probably, it's probably worth having some conversations with those landowners. Are they ever interested in selling their lands and putting it into conservation. Identifying the multiple benefits for a project. Levees are built for flood control. And there's generally a resistance to try and adapt them and change them if because you don't want to increase flood risk for someone. So you need to make sure that you are you're going to be making a change that will further reduce flood risk, but if you also find the other benefits it can have, whether it's going to trap nutrients, whether it's going to provide habitat for endangered species, those are incredibly powerful drivers and they bring in other sources of funding. If you can combine different sources of funding from different agencies, different states, that is always important to find your local cost share and get people on board. Getting the landowners on board, like I said, if somebody doesn't want to sell their private land, then it's not going to move forward. Finally, looking at the long-term cost-benefit analysis. How many times has this project failed? How many times have we rebuilt it, the same levee over and over again? What are we projected to invest in the future? There have been a number of policy changes in recent years that I think are helping to drive the Corps to do look at more non-structural approaches to levees after disasters. In WERDA 2014, we were attempting to try and push some language that would facilitate these projects. So they did include some minor adjustments to the language, including this one, saying the Chief of Engineers may include modifications to the structure of a project that at least helps clear away some of the uncertainty about whether the Corps has the authority to do these or not. And in general, the administration has been extremely supportive of identifying and removing barriers to making these resilient investments in infrastructure. And finally, the Corps is doing a rulemaking on their PL 8499 program. I tried to get an update on this and was told by several people, we really don't know, but hopefully they will come out with their rule before the administration is over. No real news on that, although I did hear from another staffer that they were very optimistic. They had heard that there were some changes that would facilitate levee setbacks and other projects, so we'll see. But in the Water Protection Network submitted comments during the scoping for that rulemaking and made a number of recommendations that hopefully they will consider, including basically making sure that the system-wide improvement frameworks, which is basically a framework for looking at your levees as a system rather than individual projects. It would encourage multiple benefit projects, coordinating with the natural resource programs in case there are endangered species habitat restoration projects going on in the area, making sure that you work together to move those forward. Planning before the flood hits, prioritizing those repetitively damaged structures, eliminating the built-in bias against non-structural, which hopefully that word of language addressed, and revising their cost-benefit analysis. So that's it.